The next case we have on today's docket is United States versus Delmazzi, and this is going to be an argument on the specified issue. Parties ready? Okay, we'll hear from the appellant.
Good morning, Chief Judge Erdman, and may it please the court. I am Major John Legg, and I, along with my co-counsel, Mr. Brian Miser, represent Lieutenant Nicole Delmazzi, the appellant. Chief Justice Marshall stated, the commission is not necessarily the appointment, though conclusive evidence of it. The issues that this court previously granted for review are not moot for two reasons. First, in terms of Section 973, the issues are not moot because Judge Mitchell, in the words of that statute, exercised the functions of his civil office upon taking the oath and at the request of the executive branch, making rulings prior to the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals decision in this matter. Second, the Appointments Clause issue is also not moot because, in the words of Justice Marshall, Judge Mitchell undertook public acts that were accompanied with public acts of the executive branch, which recognized his appointment before the delivery of
counsel. The public acts mentioned in Marbury aren't the public acts of the appointee. They're the acts of the president. What has the president done? What did the president or his designee do between advice and consent and the signing and issuance of the commission that in any way evinced an intent to appoint?
Judge Stuckey, I respectfully disagree with the presupposition, but I will answer the question and then deal with the presupposition if I may. First of all, the acts on the part of the executive branch were performed when the prosecution of the Office of Military Commissions, immediately upon the confirmation of Judge Mitchell and Judge King, filed motions requesting that prior stays be lifted and recognizing, in effect, that the concerns of the District of Columbia Circuit, the Appointments Clause concerns, had been resolved.
That's an action by the prosecution. They can file motions anytime they want. That doesn't mean he can rule on them under a presidential appointment before he's not appointed. Now, of course, we have the wrinkle here that he already got appointed by the Secretary of Defense. So he's sitting. So in a sense, the fact the prosecution did something is meaningless.
Judge Stuckey, I don't think that the acts of the executive branch here that were acquiesced to or ratified by the executive, there has been no
acquiesced to or ratified, that's purely negative. Poor Mr. Marbury wanted to be a justice of the peace. It was confirmed. The Senate confirmed it. It was signed. Madison sat on it. Did Mr. Marbury get to be a justice of the peace? No, Mr. Marbury didn't.
Judge Stuckey, respectfully, he did not because of the remedy not being
because
available.
Of the remedy not being present. Are you saying that otherwise, if the remedy had been present and they had mandamused Marbury and somebody had gone over to the State Department and grabbed the commission and handed it to Marbury, then, he could have been a justice of the peace. But here you've got the situation where the commission's not only still sitting over there, it hasn't been signed. Nobody's appointed him except the Secretary of Defense. So the fact that he did this, I don't think means anything. But tell me what public acts were performed, positive acts as opposed to sitting there letting this go on, were performed by any the president or any high-ranking official evincing an intent to appoint before the commission was signed?
Well, a few, Judge Stuckey. You have, we've pointed to the oath of office that was signed by the clerk of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals in her capacity as the clerk that Judge Mitchell took on May 2nd before he entered a ruling also on May 2nd.
Did someone from the administration tell him to do that?
Well, I don't think that we have.
Do we have any evidence or record around that? Because normally the White House tells you when you can take the oath, and you can't take it until the White House tells you, and the White House tells you you can't take it until the commission is signed, having some familiarity with this process. No, did someone from the White House or did someone from OSD tell him to take the oath? Is there any evidence or record?
There's no evidence that that's in the record, but the clerk of the USCMCR maintained his oath in its file as our motion.
Well, no, but that's not my question.
I understand, Judge Stuckey, and I think if you will work with me here, I think that we can all agree that this is an exceedingly rare or unique situation where you have the government, the appellate government division representing the United States on December 1st saying that Judge Mitchell had not been appointed until May 25th, but you have the government before the D.C. Circuit in the Nashiri case representing that Judge Mitchell's appointment had been consummated. So I think that...
Doesn't that underscore why we need to look at an act by the president rather than some functionary where it may be fine if we're looking at one position, but as you've just pointed out, you've got different branches of the executive working apparently at opposites with one another. Doesn't that hurt your case?
Judge Olson, I appreciate you bringing me back to that presupposition because I want to point to the language of Marbury because Marshall says it follows from the existence of this distinction that if an appointment was to be evidenced by any public act other than the commission, the performance of such public act would create the officer, and if he was not removable at the will of the president, would either give him the right to his commission or enable him to perform his duties without it. I submit to this court that Justice Marshall is referring him in that paragraph, is referring to the actor. I don't think that history, the opinions of the Attorney General or of this court or the Supreme Court, give us a situation where the executive has challenged the appointment of a judicial official that was confirmed by the executive, and the executive requested that the judicial official take action in the capacity of his new office.
Well, the whole problem, counsel, though, is that the appointment, it's the point in time of the appointment that removes the president's ability to change his mind, right?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that
Marshall... Nomination, confirmation, appointment. Once the appointment's happened, president can't change his mind.
Absolutely.
And so therefore, the appointment has to be an act by the president, not an act by the person upon whom the nomination or the nomination and the confirmation affect.
But, Judge Ryan, that act by the president...
By yourself.
that act by the president, I submit... can be evidenced by public acts. So,
it has to be public acts of the president, not public acts of functionaries that work for the president, right? In this case, I mean, you need to have an appointment.
I think that there's authority from the Federal Circuit which specifically rejects that functionaries cannot act for the president. In the Dysart opinion, there are opinions of the Federal Circuit that reference that subordinate officers of the president can act for him.
Your appointments?
Yeah, they can act for him in certain respects. But
your argument is that the appointee, by taking an action, can essentially appoint themselves.
At the request of the executive.
And where do we have the request by the executive? And where is that language?
Well, the appointee here, Judge Mitchell, when he ruled on May 2nd, on a request by the government that was filed on April 29th, immediately after the confirmation, he was acting at the request of the executive branch. And presumably, if the executive did not think he was authorized, he certainly could have challenged that rather than subsequently delivering the commission, which is evidence of the appointment.
But the problem, counsel, is that if the only person that can appoint, the only person that can appoint someone in this context is the president, right? The act or the public act has to be by the president. So I think I would agree this would be a very different case if the president called up this judge and said, you know, I'm really sorry, but we're out of ink. I can't sign your appointment today, but I desire that you be appointed. Consider it done. Okay? That would be a different case. That's not this case.
That might be more analogous to this court's decision in Nettles regarding the certificate and that sort of thing.
They were out of paper in Nettles.
Yeah, you agree, don't you, as a constitutional proposition that advice and consent by the Senate clears the way for the president to make the appointment, but in no way requires it.
I think that that's indisputable from Marbury, the opinions of the Attorney General. So I don't think that what we are arguing requires any disagreement with any existing law. What we're dealing with is what is necessary versus sufficient for an appointment. And, of course, Marbury held that the commission is sufficient evidence of the appointment. In fact, it's perfect evidence of the appointment that cannot be contested, which is perhaps why it's prudent that the president commissions all officers of the United States.
It's also required by the Constitution.
As a duty of the president. But yeah. I don't think it should be ignored that even Justice Robert Jackson referred to that duty as not to minimize it, but he referred to it as a mere trifling. The commission is merely perfect evidence. But what this court has to consider is whether other acts can be evidence of that appointment.
Yeah.
Okay, so even if we accept that conflation of executive branch with the president, why would the particular acts here rise to the level where we could say this was good enough for government work to constitute an appointment?
Well, I think if it's not, Judge Olson, it presents a troubling issue of how long the president can hold over the head of one of his appointees' delivery of the commission. We know from Humphrey's executor.
But he's not an appointee if he's holding over his head the commission, right?
He can hold it forever.
That's right. He doesn't have to appoint him.
Well, I guess what I would posit.
Humphrey's executor is different. Humphrey's executor is a removal case.
Well, this is the hypothetical that I would propose that would illustrate the problem with allowing the president indefinitely to withhold the commission. The president, how many times can the president ask this official to rule and still later
Wait a minute. Are we talking about the president signing a commission and then dangling it? Or are we talking about the president not signing a commission at all?
I would say, let's say not signing the commission
okay,
at all.
Okay, well then the president, under 200 years of constitutional law, has no compulsion to make the appointment. He can say, I've decided I can't stand you. Get out of here. I don't care what the Senate said. Article 2 lets him do that.
Judge Stuckey, I would
because they're his people, right? These are presidential appointments and nominations and whatever, and he has to do it with the advice and consent of the Senate, right? But up until the time, and that was the point I made originally, which is up until the time that the appointment is made and the commission is evidence of it, he can change his mind.
Well, it's perfect evidence of it, Your Honor, but I don't think that the president could ask his nominee, his confirmed nominee, to make rulings, for example,
years. There was someone in the Office of Legal Counsel during the Bush administration that never got confirmed by the Senate, all right, never got, he was an acting head of OLC the entire time that he sat in that job. And it's constitutional. Is it optimal? No. Is it permissible? Yes.
The question is more clearly the constitutional problem is more clearly presented in the case of a judicial officer. certainly an advisor of the president, such as in the Office of Legal Counsel, who indefinitely stays, you know, that certainly is an issue, but it's a more troubling issue, as it is here, where you have a quasi-judicial officer who's been asked to rule by the executive branch. The president cannot ask publicly for those rulings, yet hold over his head the possibility that he will never appoint him if he doesn't like the rulings.
But we don't have any evidence that was what it was just to be clear, there's no evidence that was what was happening here, right? It just was, it fell through the cracks. It didn't happen until May 25th. I mean, the commission.
The commission did not, was not delivered.
Can I ask you a question just to think about before you come back on rebuttal, which is, if we disagree with you about what is needed to have evidence of the appointment, what's your best argument, or do you have one?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Counsel,
I have one additional question. If we were to hold that this was moot, where does that leave the posture of the case in regard to the Appointments Clause issue identified by the D.C. Circuit?
Judge Erdman, if I could reserve both of those for rebuttal.
I have one more. Take it for rebuttal, too. President Eisenhower appointed Justice Brennan to the Supreme Court on a recess appointment in 1956. A recess appointment expires at the end of the relevant session. The essence of an Article III appointment is tenure during good behavior. You had Justice Brennan sitting there performing official acts without tenure during good behavior. If the president had decided somewhere during that time that he made the wrong choice, what then? And didn't nominate him when the Senate came back.
But Stuckey, I think there's an opinion of the Attorney General that will address that.
Okay,
I'll handle that.
You can address it in rebuttal.
Okay, we'll hear from the government now.
Chief Judge, Your Honors. May it please the Court, good morning. I am Major Matt Osborne, and I, along with Colonel Catherine Oler, represent the United States in this matter. Colonel Mitchell was not yet appointed by the President as an appellate military judge on the CMCR when he participated as an Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals appellate judge and appellant's Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals decision on the 12th of May of this year. Thus, any issues related to Colonel Mitchell's appointment to the CMCR and any potential impacts that appointment had on his status as either a military officer or as an Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals judge are moot as it relates to appellant's Air Force Court decision or Colonel Mitchell's petition.
Well, now, he's already sitting, you know, the devilish complexity here is he's already sitting there by virtue of an appointment made by a head of department under Article II. As an inferior officer, as an inferior officer, he's sitting there now. The Secretary of Defense is the head of a department, and he appointed him some time back then. So it's not his status as a CMCR judge, is it? It's the appointments clause issue.
Absolutely,
it's not the civil office issue because he's sitting there doing this. If it's a civil office, by virtue of his SecDef appointment, it's if anything's moot here, it's only issue two, right?
I would say it's both.
Why?
Because
he's already sitting there by virtue of another appointment.
Well, he had been assigned there; he had not been appointed by the president. So
no. I know that, but the Secretary of Defense put him there, right?
That's correct.
The TJAG didn't put him there. The TJAG put him on the Air Force Court, but the Secretary of Defense put him on the CMCR. The Secretary of Defense is the head of a department. The TJAG isn't. So why isn't the civil office part of this a live issue?
I think because the civil office part comes as a result of the appointment and the appointments clause. So since he had only been assigned...
Well, I guess it really defines, it depends on whether sitting on the CMCR is a civil office. Right?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. What does it depend on?
But it depends on how he got there. So And even in
the Would it be that he's not really sitting there until he has his commission, and he didn't have his commission until after this case?
As an appointed appellate military judge, as an assigned one, and I don't think there has been any indication by the appellant, and I can look back at the brief, that the fact that his assigned military judge position made it a civil law. Their whole contention is once he was appointed, it became a civil office because he was now a presidential.
Because he's now a presidential appointee.
Right.
So if he's. Because he's a principal. Is it because he's a principal officer?
Well, we're not saying he's a principal officer.
Well, that's I'm not saying he's a principal officer either.
The appellant's contention is because of the appointment by the president, that then made Colonel Mitchell now appointed to a civil office, which then also made him a principal
and
officer.
And oust his commission.
Correct.
Oust his military.
Yeah, right. To the point that they're calling him Mr. in briefs. But the point of that was the appointment is what started that train off the tracks, not the fact that he had previously been assigned. So the reason both issues would be mooted is because he was not yet appointed as an appellate military judge at CMCR on the 12th of May.
That did not happen
until the 25th. That did not happen until the 25th of May.
Right, by the president.
So to get back and kind of to the basics of this, right, we go back to Marbury, to the Constitution, Article 2 saying the president provides the power to the president to nominate and to appoint with the consent and advice of the Senate. And then we have Marbury, which gives us the process for the appointments. It's the nomination, which it says is the sole act of the president, and then it says the appointment. This is also the act of the president and is also a voluntary act, though it can only be performed by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. Now, appellate in their argument quoted correctly from that argument where it said, if an appointment was to be evidenced by any public act other than the commission, the performance of such public act would create the officer. That's on page 156 of that opinion. The next page, 157, though, goes a little bit further, and it says, quote, the appointment being the sole act of the president, but be completely evidenced when it is shown that he has done everything to be performed by him. It goes on later, quote, evidenced by an open, unequivocal act and being the last act required from the person making it, which would be the president. Two pages later, on page 159 of that, quote, the appointment being under the Constitution to be made by the president personally. And then on page 161, it again says, quote, the appointment is the sole act of the president. So the appointment here has to be done by an act of the president, whether it be a commission or some other public act. So going back to our situation, and Judge Ryan, what you mentioned, it's as if the president had been at the swearing-in on the 2nd of May, you know, and had participated in that, that could have been a public act, and then we're talking about a whole other different thing. But right now, the only evidence we have in the record is the certificate, the commission, from the 25th of May. And it's kind of like in Marbury, when it said, this is an appointment by the president, and in that case, it essentially said, you know, here, the appointment and the commission were the same thing, because that was the
Would you address the oath? Because he took the oath well before the commission was signed.
Correct.
Which is backwards. Normally, the White House tells you when you can take the oath, and you can't take the oath until the commission's issued. So would you address the issue of the oath? What's going on here? Is that a public act? Is there anything in the record that says why he took the oath when he did? Or did some executive minion tell him to? Or did the president tell him to? I don't know. Because that is evidence, or it could be evidence.
I think it's evidence of a bigger issue with essentially the parties in this case not necessarily knowing the process of how this exactly works, and assuming that the Senate confirmation equals appointments good to go, let's roll. And that's evidence by the very next day after the Senate confirmation, we have the prosecution of the OMC filing to lift the stay. I mean, certainly the president is not going to act within 24 hours of the Senate on the appointment. Going back to the oath.
Can you fix the process? We've got about a million trailer cases to this.
What's that, Your Honor?
You fixed the process.
Well, I think we now know, and this court has certainly smartened everyone up to knowing the process. And certainly, Your Honor, I, don't know. I've never been a part of that process, and after this case, maybe never will. But I think the point here is not the public acts, or any acts, matter of fact, of the appointee. It's the acts of the appointer, and in this case, it's the acts of the president. And the only evidence in the record that we have of the act of the president is his signature upon that certificate, upon that commission on the 25th, which says exactly that on this date. It doesn't say did on the 2nd of May appoint, and now we're going to sign the commission. It said on this date, the 25th of May. So that is where we are, or where we're looking at. Excuse me. I think it's also interesting to look to, if we're looking at the acts of, and in this case we're looking at the acts of the Office of the Prosecution of the OMC. I already mentioned that the next day is when they filed, so certainly very quick. Even before, you know, Colonel Mitchell took his oath, they were already filing. So,
By the way, do you know if he took the oath again after he was commissioned?
I am not aware.
Okay. Okay. Never, go ahead.
Too, that the appellant brings up is the orders and the rulings that the CMCR put out. And in those, you'll notice that they specifically mention the date of when the president nominated the judges, also the date that the Senate confirmed them, but is silent on when the president appointed them. So if this was a case to where the president called Colonel Mitchell and said, hey, the certificate's not going to be done until the 25th, but you're good to go. If that was on the 2nd, you'd think that would be mentioned in their ruling, because that's kind of that would seem to be a big deal, and that's not there. So I think my point is the evidence shows, certainly in the record, that the only thing that's there is the commission that was done on the 25th by the president, which also served as the appointment of Colonel Mitchell to the CMCR as an appointed military appellate judge. So because of that, that is why the opinion of the Air Force Court that took place 13 days earlier on the 12th, at that point he was not an appointed official. And so even assuming that the two original issues did somehow impact his ability to be a military officer or to be an Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals judge, it certainly didn't impact this case because that opinion had already been completed. And if there's no further questions.
Thank you, Counsel. Rebuttal.
Your Honors, if I can, with some great trepidation, attempt to answer the three questions in reverse order. First of all, with regard to the recess appointment issue, Judge Stuckey, that you mentioned, and I'll provide this in a supplemental 36A letter to the court, but 12 Opinion Attorney General 304 is an opinion of the Attorney General from 1867, which respects a recess appointment. And essentially in that case, it's a person who is commissioned to be an agent for an Indian tribe, and then there is, and that's a recess appointment, and then there's a subsequent appointment that is then rejected by the Senate, and there's this issue of whether or not that earlier recess appointment was still valid, and the Attorney General comes to the conclusion that it was valid, at least during
that. Well, is that a de facto officer case, or what are you talking about? Is the gravamen of the opinion the validity of the acts performed under the recess appointment?
I'm asking.
I don't know.
I don't think it's a de facto officer case, but
well, it wasn't really. He's a de jure officer because he's appointed under constitutional authority because the recess appointments clause is in the Constitution. What was the question?
Well, it's essentially.
I mean, what question was the AG answering?
Whether the first appointment was valid, and like I said, I
will. Oh, valid is a recess appointment?
And whether upon the nomination of the officer to replace him, whether that
Okay.
And of course, this is written in 1867 English, which may be better than my English before this court. But
probably better than any English in this court. Anyway.
But I'll submit it to the court for its consideration. Okay, but I think essentially a recess appointment would be.
Yeah, now of course, you know, you don't have the Article III wrinkle that you had with Brennan, but nonetheless, yeah.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I think the essence of the remaining two questions were, and of course the court will correct me if I'm wrong, but what if the court disagrees with the position of appellant with regard to the mootness on the appointments clause issue? I think that the 973 issue must be decided by the court because of Judge Mitchell exercising the functions of that civil office as evidenced by the opinions that he issued by him taking the oath. And these are actions by, you have the clerk of the USCMCR who maintained the oath in his files and provided it to the appellant, which we provided to the court in response to its order. You have the executive branch official who swore Judge Mitchell in, the clerk of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. And then, of course, you have Judge Mitchell who, after a 15-month stay, solely because of appointments clause concerns, proceeds to lift the stay and interacts, exercising the functions of that civil office. And so I think that that issue cannot be moot, as the government has stated, even if the appointments clause issue.
Does the statute prohibit them from taking actions, or does it prohibit them from taking office?
The words of the statute are exercising the function. Page 93 of the joint appendix. Except as authorized by law, an officer to whom this subsection applies may not hold or exercise the functions of a civil office. So I think that that question is still clearly presented before this court, given that after a 15-month stay, Judge Mitchell lifted the stay, takes the oath, and begins to exercise the functions of
that. Well, the problem is he was there before exercising the functions under a different appointment.
But there would have been no need, no reason for him to do that if at the request of the government they believed that this solved the process. So he believed at that point, clearly, all this time that had passed, that he had been appointed and he exercised the functions of that.
Yeah, but is it a subjective or an objective standard? He believed he'd been appointed. But he wasn't appointed.
Certainly to the parties involved, any reasonable member of the public who was not able to go to Judge Mitchell's private office and take a snapshot of his commission would believe that he was appointed under those circumstances. Your Honor, I have exceeded my time.
Finished responding to the questions?
That is for the court to decide, Your Honor. I'm certainly available if there are further questions.
I think that takes care of the question session for today.
Thank you, Chief Judge.
Thank you. We thank counsel for both parties. And the case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until further order of the court.
All rise. Court is adjourned until further order of the court.